Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli, and today we've got a special guest, as usual, who's going to be sort of entertaining us with an insight into neuroscience, and especially, you know, how do people become addicted? We know that you're addicted to Science Studio. Why is that? We never are very clear about that, but perhaps today, Russ, we'll find out. So, Russ, who is our guest?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Ulysses Ricoy. He's the chair of biology, chemistry, and environmental science at Northern New Mexico College. Welcome to Science Studio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Really, it's a pleasure.
Española is where you are.
Española,
North
New Mexico.
Of Santa Fe and just a little bit to the right of Los Alamos.
The heart of the Rio Grande Valley. Yeah.
Now, tell us, before we get into neuroscience, addiction, behavior, methamphetamine,
sure,
and all these issues that so frequently come up in this modern day and age. Let's talk about Ulysses a little bit. How did you get into this game of being a scientist?
Sure. I think that really my family history has a big player. My father was a geologist, and my mom is a sociologist. And so even though I grew up in inner city, Mexico City, not with a lot of resources.
Oh, you're a Chilango.
Chilango, yeah,
Ay,
that's right.
Bienvenidos, El Paso.
Muchas gracias, muchas gracias. Their influence was huge. In essentially, as far as I can remember, they always encouraged us to ask questions. And so to me, that was just part of growing up. I always enjoyed looking at critters and cockroaches and grasshoppers and, you know, cutting them open and seeing what's in there.
Chapulinos, right?
Exactly. Chapulines. So it was kind of a natural process. But the one hallmark that I want to mention is that when I was in college, I remember being at work study. I was an engineering major.
Where was that, by the way?
That was in UT San Antonio.
San Antonio, okay.
So I was a work study. I was an engineering declared major. And my shift was on Sundays, which was a great day to study, because nobody would go. And there was a professor that later I found out was a professor of biochemistry. He walked into the room to check out some microfilms. I checked them out, and he saw me studying chemistry. And he told me, you know what? He introduced me for the first time of the MARC program. And I wanted to mention that because I know that one of you guys direct the MARC program here at UT El Paso. And so for those that are listening to this, I was a student. I had never heard of the MARC program. And the acronym stands for Minority Access to Research Careers. And this is I believe this is the oldest underrepresented research training program in the United States, funded by the NIH, the National Institute of General Medical Sciences. So, long story short, that changed my life. I left being at work study. I started washing dishes in a lab. And before you know it, I was doing that in a neurobiology lab. And so it was sort of by...
It's like the old-fashioned press gangs.
That's right.
You know, wandering around London looking for itinerant people and then dragging them into the Navy.
Absolutely. And so, you know, I didn't know much about science other than asking questions and being curious, but I was still very sort of naive of the science process and how you ask questions. And I like to tell my students now that don't get married to techniques. All they are tools.
Yes.
The tools will change. They will always change, you know. But it's so difficult because we do live in a world in which it's almost you're being measured by how great of a technician you are and how great of a storyteller you are based on your technique. So long story short, I mean, that was the beginning of my formal scientific career, right?
So what did you do? Because most of the MARC students in the program here have to do a research
project.
That's
right. So what I did as an undergraduate is that I assisted with feeding a group of rodents. They were rats, and I was responsible for handling them daily. I was responsible for feeding them. I was responsible for taking them out of their cage.
This was in UTSA.
UT San Antonio, yeah. My task was, I was a research assistant, and I was assisting in a project in which rodents had to navigate in a water maze to find a submerged platform. And the whole goal of this was
Sorry,
to...
Wait, wait. underwater.
Underwater, yeah. So rodents, if you put a rodent in a water,
yeah,
in a water recipient, they will naturally try to get out of it, and so they'll swim.
Yeah, right.
And by chance, they will stumble upon a submerged platform. And so if you do this in repeated trials...
They learn.
They learn, exactly. And so it's a very classic way...
So it's a fixed right. geometry.
That's right. It's a spatial-dependent yeah. task.
Right. And then it always Correct. The platform's in the same place. Correct. So it's a matter of where you drop them
That's
in.
That's exactly right. And so in the field of psychology, of learning and memory... For those folks that are interested in biological processes, it has been a very classic method to examine the neurobiology of learning and memory. And so that was really the beginning of my...
Right. No, this is great.
Can I take you back, though? Yeah. You started in Mexico City, and you know, both of us have been there a lot. Okay. Were you there during the big earthquake?
I was. I completely... And that's a great question because... The reason that I can remember exactly what I was doing, I was brushing my teeth, I was getting ready to go to school, and my brother was standing right next to me, and my mom was in the other room, and it was in my house right next to Mercado de la Bola. I remember exactly. It was about 7:50 a.m., and the reason that I can recall all of these details is because of memory, mm-hmm. right? Because of the hippocampus, which is an area of the brain that later I became passionate about and study. But yes, I was there.
Let's jump ahead Absolutely. Now a little bit, because then after your experience as an undergraduate, you've sort of been turned on to experimental biology, if you
Absolutely.
Like, and psychology.
Absolutely.
Where did you then continue your studies?
So I was always driven to study ecosystems. And as an undergraduate. So even though I was very lucky to work as a Marx student, during the summers, I was very fortunate that I had the opportunity to do two oceanography summer internships as an undergraduate. One of them was in the Laguna Madre in Port Aransas.
Yes.
UT Austin has a marine science institute there. And then the other one was at Scripps Institute of Oceanography in La Jolla. And then the third summer program that I did was an international medical training program in Nigeria. And that was studying goiter disease. So because of the summer programs that I did in oceanography, I got accepted into a master's program in biological oceanography at San Francisco State University. So that's what I did. And so even though a lot of my mentors mm-hmm. told me, don't leave neuroscience, it's your call, and you're very passionate about it, I was still very...
In any of those places that you mentioned, you must have heard a lot about deep sea vents and the strange, life
absolutely,
down there.
Absolutely.
You tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so, you know, in biology, if you're a student in biology, it is safe to say that for the most part, you will learn that all life originates from the sun. And that's actually not entirely true. I mean, we know that there are communities that are dependent on chemosynthesis. And so there's a number of deep sea vents. In fact, one of the first vents, the first vent was discovered in the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that you say that because the director of the program at San Francisco State when I arrived was the lead scientist on board of the Alvin. Alvin was the submergible that was used, and that's when they discovered the worms.
Yeah,
that were living, and they were forming
in the dark.
In the dark, they had a symbiotic relationship with bacteria that were able to fix some of the chemicals that were seeping from the vents. It's very, very interesting.
So, I mean, you really are sort of outlining a whole wonderful series of different
absolutely
sort of arrows into you, Ulysses, from different branches.
Yeah.
So you finally went somewhere. We've got to move along a little. You studied for a PhD where?
So long story short, I went from San Francisco. I went back to Mexico City for family obligations. It's a long story, but when I was in Nigeria, I caught malaria and I relapsed from malaria while I was in the Bay Area.
Right.
So I went back to Mexico City where I grew up. And in order for me to get back into school, I was invited to participate in a master's program in addiction studies because they knew I had neurobiology background. So I did it. And I even started working as a drug abuse counselor because I needed to pay rent. And it was as a result of that that I started giving talks on neurobiology of disease, neurobiology of drug abuse. So I went back to UT San Antonio to work with my former PhD mentor, Joe Martinez. And I was very interested in how we learn, but not so much like rats to navigate spatially, how we learn to take drugs. And this is something that we learn. We're not born with this. We learn this.
You know, there's so much study on addiction and how you learn, as you just said. I've never thought about the way that you phrase it, what you learn to take drugs.
That's right.
We seem to know quite a bit, and we'll come on to that in the second part of the program. Is there as much knowledge on how we learn to learn? Because, you know, this predisposition to always study learning bad habits.
Right.
But why aren't we more clever at making people learn the good habits?
Yeah.
We'll come back to that after a short break.
All right.
We're talking to Ulysses Ricoy from New Mexico College in Española in northern New Mexico. I'm Keith Pannell here with Russ Chinelli. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. We've learned from war vets in the past decade that traumatic brain injuries, or TBI, are chronic diseases and not just one-time events as we had assumed for years.
Victims of car wrecks, falls, and sports injuries also get TBI, which is often called a silent injury because it's not always obvious, even to the person hurt. Symptoms can simply be slower reaction times and poorer memory.
Sadly, there's no cure, and each person experiences brain injury uniquely. What's worse is once people get TBI, they're also at greater risk for developing dementia.
Most people are diagnosed through symptoms, since there's no approved method for confirming a diagnosis. In an autopsy, dementia is found when a protein called tau is clustered in certain areas of the brain that impairs normal processes.
One of the more toxic forms of tau aggregate, called oligomeric tau, may perpetuate the cell death processes in the hours and weeks after the injury. Researchers at UTMB have developed an antibody that detects this toxic form of tau protein.
Next, they plan to use a similar antibody to bind to and inactivate the tau oligomers to prevent further damage and cognitive dysfunction.
This antibody appears to improve memory and learning in rodents with Alzheimer's disease. Researchers are working to ensure it's safe and effective in animals before they move on to human trials.
At some point in the future, this antibody might be used as a therapeutic vaccine for many neurodegenerative disorders, as well as for traumatic brain injury.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell here with Russ Chinelli. And our guest today, Professor Ulysses Ricoy. He's from the New Mexico College in Española. And he's into neuroscience of addiction. And we're going to get into that now.
Sure,
but just let's revisit that question, though. That if we're so clever at studying what makes people learn to do bad things, are we as clever at understanding how we can make people to learn good things?
No, that's a great question. I think that a lot of the research has little by little revealed some of the basic cellular mechanisms, or at least some of the ones that we understand today that essentially make up what learning is. And so learning something is just as important as the ability to forget something. And so if you think of the brain as this organ that allows you to learn something that is useful for your survival, but you don't, at the same time, you don't want to remember everything, right? So, for example, like you don't want to necessarily remember all of the cars that you pass on the freeway to get to the studio this morning, right? I mean, that's not useful anymore. It was definitely useful when you were driving,
but I think lots of kids growing up watching James Bond.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we'll always marvel that James Bond recognized that car passed 10 miles earlier on.
And so it's kind of like saying that like in a studio you have instrumentation and some of it is to edit, some of it is to record, some of it is to replay. And I think that those are all parts that we are beginning to understand how they play with each other. And so when we talk about learning, for example, addictive behaviors, we are now beginning to, for example, there's a lot of literature from neuroscientists that talk about recovery and how is it that, for example, an addict, for example, has to unlearn and relearn or learn something completely new that you would get from, for example, 12-step programs.
Let's just go into that.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
Unlearning. Is that what you just said? Sounds common sense in one sense. But in another way, you say, do you have to unlearn before you can learn? You don't have to erase what's on a tape recorder in order to tape over it.
Correct.
So you've never actually removed or unlearned.
Right.
It's still there if you know clever enough how to get to it.
Right.
So do we unlearn? Can you unlearn something?
Well, the way that you phrase that question is precisely that's where the nuts and bolts of a lot of debate is in the field of neuroscience. So there's a lot of people that want to understand, do you unlearn the semantics of saying unlearning? Is that safe to say? Are you recording over it?
Right.
What exactly is happening? And so it's not very clear, but what I can tell you it's clear is that we now have an understanding that something like drug abuse, it's not just the basic circuitry that it was once thought from two brain regions. Now we know that it involves
everything.
The prefrontal cortex, it involves the basal forebrain, it involves the hippocampus, it involves the amygdala, so there's an emotional component, there's a decision-making component.
You know, there's a behavior, neurology, and then there's the chemistry.
Correct.
And I realize that in some cases people are talking about inhibitors, that if you're, a opium or
exactly.
whatever it is, you take this drug and it blocks that. Can you
right.
talk a little bit about
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. So a lot of what we know today in the field, in actually in all science, but particularly in neuroscience, you know, you apply a drug to, let's say, a cell. And I always tell my students, if you apply a drug to a cell and you ask the question, what does that drug do to that cell? Does it increase its firing rate? Does it decrease its firing rate? What does that mean? Does when it increases the firing rate, does it mean that it releases more neurotransmitter? Well, that basic question, we didn't know that for a long time, actually.
Because now we do.
So it is safe to say that one of the things that we now know about drugs of abuse, one of the things that they all have in common is that they all have this remarkable ability to enhance the level of dopamine of the mesolimbic system. That's something that it's pretty much safe to say in a room full of neuroscientists with PhDs, and there's not going to be any ego contest on this. I mean, it's pretty much safe to say that people will, for the most part, agree on this.
What is dopamine?
Absolutely. So dopamine, it's a neurochemical. It's a molecule. It's extremely important. And if you were to ask what is its function, it has a lot of functions. It is involved with movement. So not surprisingly, dopamine is involved in Parkinson's disease, which is a disease that involves neurodegeneration of movement. That's one aspect. Another aspect is that it plays a role in learning. We don't know exactly what exactly it does, but we know it modulates learning.
It's involved in all these processes.
Yeah, so one of the things that people think that dopamine is involved is that when you learn something, your salience, your attention span increases with something when dopamine's on board. So, for example, when you eat a cookie, when you have sex, when you get excited about something, the levels of dopamine rise. And it is safe to say that the reason they rise is because the cells that release dopamine, they fire in rhythm, okay? They're always firing. And then when there's excitement...
Wait. In rhythm. You mean there's concerted...
Right, like a heartbeat.
Cellular, right?
Toof, like a pacemaker,
yeah.
Right? And then when something exciting, when something happens, like a stimulus, all of a sudden there is a burst of firing of these cells.
Now, how far back can we take this molecule? Does it exist in E. coli?
Absolutely. Or? So that's a very interesting question because, so dopamine has, for those that are chemists in your hearing about this, it has a classic benzene ring, okay? So it's a molecule that is found in plants. So not surprisingly, the reason that people take psychostimulants is because all of those drugs, the structure of those molecules mimic, it looks remarkably similar to the structure of dopamine. In fact, it is so similar that they have the ability to bind in the same receptor as dopamine binds to. And so it's almost like they have a master key and they have the ability to get in there and tweak with the brain circuitry. So in a way, the brain is being fooled.
Can they screw up the ability for dopamine to interact
with
that same receptor?
Absolutely.
So it's a sort of non-competitive.
Absolutely.
You also have to ask, where did it get its name?
You know, it is a great question because when you have these natural stimulant or natural rewards like food and sex and social, like, for example, in human organisms that we're social, gambling releases dopamine. I mean, even Facebook releases dopamine.
But studying physical chemistry, that doesn't seem to involve too much generation of dopamine. Why can't we change the way we teach some of these things?
So, I mean, I think what's important to look at is that there's a number of compounds that, just like we found out about dopamine, that we don't know that they're there, right? So there's a lot of compounds that have been found with standard analytical chemistry.
Right.
So, for example, like a very good example, it's cannabis, THC. THC was discovered by using analytical chemistry. It was discovered in an analytical chemistry lab by a guy that was not a neuroscientist, right? So, I mean, it's a very remarkable way that how chemistry...
Well, it's a central science.
Absolutely.
Russ and I both agreed on that.
Absolutely. Now, well, you guys are both chemists.
In one form or another, right. Let's go on to specifically, Ulysses, what it is that you are doing in your intellectual research activity.
Absolutely.
In this big field.
Sure. So I'm very interested in how brain cells communicate. In the end, the mechanistic aspect of how one learns, the fundamental unit of the nervous system is the neuron. And the connection between neurons are synapses, which are very small spaces in between neurons. Mm-hmm. So when neurons communicate, they're going to be releasing chemicals. We're talking about chemistry. And this communication of chemicals, that's what I would like to understand. I want to understand how this operates. How could we understand that? And so what I'm interested in doing is I'm very versatile. I like to use approaches that are reliable. I live in a place that is very underserved. And so I have worked with frogs. And the reason that I work with frogs is because you could record from the neuromuscular junction, which is the nerve-muscle interaction. And you could study synaptic transmission there. There's a lot of great questions about the machinery of synaptic release that I'm interested in.
Isn't that also where Alzheimer's disease interferes with these aggregates?
Absolutely, absolutely. And so in Alzheimer's disease, there's an aggregation of proteins, which are referred to plaques.
Yeah.
So amyloid beta protein.
They cut this off.
Absolutely. And so it is believed, and this is a hypothesis still. I mean, it's not really common knowledge. I mean, it's pretty much safe to say that it is believed. There's a huge group of people out there that believe that the aggregation of these plaques, of this protein, inside the cell obstruct the ability for neurotransmitter release. Now, if you were to ask me, well, wait a minute, like, what do you mean obstruct? That's when the details of answering that question began to get people very heated into discussions of how that happens. Because we don't understand how. I mean, it sounds like a great story, but we don't know how that happens. And so...
So what is it then that you are doing? What experiments are you doing?
So
what are you doing to these synapses?
What I'm working on is I want to understand, for example, the role of heavy metals in the environment, such as barium, such as cadmium. And so we live in
I'm very grateful that you're the first person who's talked about heavy metals and didn't automatically say lead.
Yeah, so
one of my favorite elements.
People don't think about the environment and heavy metals and accumulation of toxins, but there is definitely, in my view, there's definitely a correlation of the anthropogenic impact on all systems, right? And so we are responsible for mining, and every single time you mine,
are you going to tell us that drug addiction may be related to accumulating heavy metals?
Perhaps. I mean, what I'm suggesting is that what I'm interested in as a synaptic transmission person is that I want to know how I can utilize things that I know from my world, and one of them is heavy metals, because I know that heavy metals affect synaptic transmission. I also know that.
Wait a minute. You've done the experiments.
We have done some experiments. Absolutely.
Tell us what the results are. What does a heavy metal do?
So heavy metals affect the release of neurotransmitters from the presynaptic terminal, and so it is safe to say that we don't exactly know how it's done, but heavy metals affect the release, the neurotransmitter release.
So you do experiments where you study this synaptic transmission.
That's exactly right. I do
it. You do it in an environment which isn't just your normal saline solution.
That's right. And there's two ways of doing it. So one way of doing it is to cut out a piece of muscle from the frog that's attached to a nerve. You stimulate the nerve with electricity. You record electrically from the muscle. Well, you have to attach drugs that paralyze the muscle so that the muscle doesn't twitch, and you don't break the actual glass electrode that you're using to record electrical activity from.
So you've disabled that.
That's
function.
Right. But you can record the synaptic transmission events.
Okay.
And if you're able to do that, then you could do that in normal conditions, and you could also do that in the presence of a heavy metal ion. Another way to do it is to expose a whole tank
of frogs
to heavy metal, which is the way that I would like to do it, because that's kind of how we humans are exposed to.
So, and you watch their behavior patterns? Is that what you're...
Not so much the behaviors, but what I'm interested in doing is I'm interested in separating the acute, the short-term effects of these compounds. But as you could see, that all of these levels of analysis are intertwined, and... That's my science philosophy. Like, I don't like to get married to a specific technique.
Well, just before we have to say goodbye, because
we're going to
say goodbye shortly.
Sure.
You've looked at this synaptic transmission. You've modified it by adding the metals. What happens to it? Do they slow down transmission
The magnitude of the signal diminishes.
Okay.
And so
So can you get to a point where the higher concentrations, there's no transmission?
Absolutely. Yeah, you can completely abolish synaptic transmission.
Now, what level do you have to get to for that? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember in the sense because I never did those experiments because I was interested in recording a signal that I could see.
Uh-huh.
And so I didn't want to wipe out the signal.
Okay.
So I stay within the millimolar range.
Oh.
But definitely, and we know that there's other people that have studied heavy metals that report that heavy metals bind to presynaptic ion channels, like calcium channels. That ultimately will, if you shut them all off, you block transmission.
Got you.
Completely.
So one last question.
Is there
any evidence from analysis that the human brain, you know, when you've gone, people study, that there are heavy metals that have crossed over the blood brain?
Yes, yes. There's a lot
So we accumulate heavy metals in our brain?
Yes. It's a fascinating topic. I personally think that all of these are areas that we don't know enough about. But there's a lot of reasons for that. So heavy metals, it's a great way to examine synaptic transmission.
Ulysses Ricoy, professor of biological sciences, New Mexico College in Española. Fascinating, fascinating. And you're a great communicator. Let me add that. You're doing a great job, I'm sure, up there, but you did a great job on Science Studio. To the audience out there, you hurry back next week and the week after and the week after. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. The new Paso del Norte Institute for Healthy Living has hired Leo Wiggum as its first executive director. Wiggum will lead the institute to becoming a model for promoting healthy eating and active living. Wiggum, who comes to El Paso from North Dakota, starts January 1st. Read more at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Sierra Providence Health Network.